Chapter 15. The Orange Contagion. On September 5, 2004, the night after Putin's Beslan speech, Viktor Yushchenko drove surreptitiously to an exclusive, gated dacha outside Kiev. He was running for president of Ukraine, and he was certain someone was trying to kill him. Accompanied by his campaign manager, but not his bodyguards, he met General Ihor Smishko, the head of the Security Service of Ukraine, or the SBU, the country's own successor to the KGB. Smishko had not wanted anyone else around. The host was Smishko's deputy, Volodymyr Satsuk, whose cook prepared a midnight meal of boiled crawfish and salad, washed down with beer, followed later by a dessert of fruit with glasses of vodka and cognac. Nothing seemed amiss. Yushchenko posed for a photograph with the two security officials and left at 2 o'clock in the morning. Later that day, he began to feel ill. His head hurt, and then so did his spine. His symptoms worsened in the days ahead, and his handsome face was soon discolored and disfigured by an eruption of cysts. In pain, he traveled to Austria on September 10th for treatment, fearful of Ukrainian hospitals. After puzzling over his symptoms for weeks, the doctors there ultimately concluded that he had ingested, presumably at the late-night dinner, one of the highest doses ever recorded in a human of a highly toxic compound known as 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzo p-dioxin, or TCDD. Ukraine's presidential election was scheduled for October 31, 2004. The winner would replace the president of the previous decade, Leonid Kuchma, an apparatchik who had been elected as a reformer in 1994, only to turn increasingly authoritarian and corrupt as Ukraine stumbled through its transition to democracy and capitalism. The country experienced the same chaos and corruption, poverty and criminality that Russia had, but there was a crucial difference. For many Ukrainians, the demise of the Soviet Union was not a catastrophe, but a liberation, the rebirth of independence from Moscow that it had experienced only very briefly in the chaotic years that followed the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. With nearly 48 million people in 2004, Ukraine was the second largest and most important of the former Soviet republics, an agricultural and industrial heartland that had been devastated by the Civil War, by the collectivization policies of Joseph Stalin, which produced a famine, and then by the Great Patriotic War, when it was occupied and ravaged by the Nazis, and then retaken again by the liberating Soviet armies. Ukraine lost more than 3 million people during the war, more than a sixth of its population at the time, and the scars were deep. Ukraine's nationhood, its national identity, remained tenuous. It was deeply divided geographically and ethnically between Ukrainians and Russians, among others, between those who embraced the liberation that came with the collapse of the Soviet Union and those who lamented its demise. Ukrainians were close to Russia, historically and culturally, but the nationalistic spirit that emerged in the country's first years of independence resembled that of the former republics like Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which had endured 5 decades of Soviet occupation and now were part of NATO and the European Union. They adopted Ukrainian symbols and Ukrainian names for cities, including the capital, which had been rendered in Russian as Kiev, K-I-E-V, for centuries, but reverted in independence to the Ukrainian style, Kiev, K-Y-I-V. Throughout his presidency, Kuchma balanced Russia on one side and the European Union, and even NATO on the other. His government retained close economic and diplomatic ties with Russia, but also dispatched Ukrainian troops to Iraq as part of the American-led coalition that was then struggling to reestablish order after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Like the country itself, he seemed conflicted. To his many critics, he simply lacked conviction. He was a kleptocrat, motivated by greed and power, beholden to the country's oligarchs. Yet he never had the will or the power to stifle politics the way Putin had, because the country's divisions ensured competing power centers. The country's oligarchs themselves had divided loyalties and ambitions, and thus were never entirely subservient. Putin had tamed Russia's oligarchs, while in Ukraine, they still threw their support and cash behind different political factions, depending on their financial interests. Democracy in Ukraine was immature, unruly, and at times vicious. But no one man dominated the country's politics. Kuchma's opponents enjoyed the support of a television network, Channel 5, which had remained free of state control, permitting a diversity of news and opinion that in turn fostered political debate. When Kuchma was implicated in the murder of a prominent journalist, Georgi Gungadze, he could not easily suppress the anti-government protests that erupted, nor could he prevent opposition members of parliament from demanding an investigation. In 2000, Gungadze's headless body was discovered in a forest outside of Kiev, only months after he founded an online investigative newspaper that infuriated Kuchma's inner circle with its rollicking reports on corruption. Conversations secretly recorded in Kuchma's office caught him railing against Gungadze's reporting and urging aides to deal with him. Kuchma denied ordering the murder, but his political career was in ruins. Many had feared that as his second term came to an end in 2004, he would try to revise the constitution to extend his rule. But in the end, Kuchma had no choice but to step aside. Unlike Russia's listless parliamentary and presidential elections in 2003 and 2004, Ukraine's remained passionately, fiercely contested, the outcomes uncertain. Putin followed Ukraine's politics closely and found them worrisome. Kuchma's dwindling credibility raised the very real possibility that the opposition could win. Putin had already watched another former Soviet republic, Georgia, succumb to a popular democratic uprising after a disputed election in 2003. It was a tiny country of 5 million people on Russia's new southern frontier, the spine of the Caucasus. The country's president, Eduard Shevardnadze, had been the former foreign minister of the Soviet Union, a close advisor of Mikhail Gorbachev, and a man many in Russia blamed for the collapse that followed perestroika. Shevardnadze returned to his native republic and stumbled into power following Georgia's violent birth as an independent state, fractured by wars, abetted by Russian fighters, which established the breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia inside the country's internationally recognized borders. After Georgia's parliamentary election in November 2003 was rigged, thousands of people poured into the streets to protest. They had the training and financing of international organizations funded by George Soros and the United States Congress, among others. When Shevardnadze tried to install the new parliament on November 22nd, the protesters stormed the building, led by the opposition leader Mikhail Saakashvili. Shevardnadze had to appeal to the Kremlin for help. He telephoned Putin that night as the latter dined with his senior advisors in one of Moscow's most famous Georgian restaurants. Putin ordered his foreign minister, Igor Ivanov, to fly to Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, to mediate, though with clear instructions not to let a mob overthrow an elected head of state. In the end, Ivanov failed, and Shevardnadze, misunderstanding the level of support he had for Moscow, resigned. The Rose Revolution, as it came to be known, thrust Saakashvili into power. The parliamentary election was followed by his election as president in January 2004. Saakashvili considered himself Georgia's Putin, a strong leader determined to restore stability to the country. In one of his first acts in office, he flew to Moscow to meet Putin, fawning over him as a political inspiration. Putin, however, was alarmed by Shevardnadze's ouster and Saakashvili's westernizing instincts. Putin responded to the fawning with a tirade about the former countries of the Warsaw Pact becoming slaves to America. Georgia's relations with Russia went downhill from there. For Putin, the stakes in Ukraine were much higher. Georgia was a rump state that posed no major threat to Moscow's influence. Ukraine, in contrast, had deep ethnic, cultural, and economic ties to Russia and to Putin. It was the historical root of Russia itself, Kievan Rus, the medieval fief whose leader, Vladimir the Great, adopted Christianity in 988, and the frontier of the Tsarist empires that followed, its name translated literally as the Ukraine, or the border. Its borders had shifted over time. Parts of its western territory had belonged to Poland or the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Stalin seized some of it with his secret pact with Hitler in 1939, and the rest after the end of the Great Patriotic War. Ukraine's modern shape took form, but it seemed ephemeral, subject to the larger forces of geopolitics, as most borderlands have been throughout history. In 1954, Nikita Khrushchev decreed that Crimea, conquered by Catherine the Great in the 18th century and heroically defended against the Nazis, would be governed by the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic from Kiev, not from Moscow. No one then, and certainly not Putin when he honeymooned there nearly two decades later, ever envisioned that Ukraine, and with it Crimea, would one day be part of another independent nation. Even now, in 2004, it seemed a historical accident that Putin, like most Russians, would tolerate only as long as the new Ukraine remained firmly nestled in Russia's geopolitical embrace. In July 2004, 3 months before Ukraine's presidential election, Putin flew to Crimea to meet with Kuchma and Viktor Yanukovych, who had been Kuchma's prime minister since 2002, when he replaced the man now running as the main opposition candidate, Viktor Yushchenko. Despite reservations from Putin, who did not consider him the best candidate, Kuchma had tapped Yanukovych as his political heir. Their meeting with Putin that July took place in Yalta, in the same building, the Livadia Palace, where the victors of the Great Patriotic War had divided the spoils of a soon-to-be-liberated Europe. Putin, too, had spheres of influence in mind that summer, and as far as he was concerned, Ukraine remained within Russia's. Putin pressed Kuchma to end his government's flirtation with the European Union and NATO. The latter was now particularly reviled in Russia as it crept further and further eastward. Only months before, in March, NATO had expanded its member nations from 19 to 26, admitting not only Bulgaria, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Romania in Eastern Europe, but the three former Soviet republics of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, each of which was home to a sizable population of Russians. Most American and European officials accepted as an article of faith that NATO's expansion would strengthen the security of the continent by forging a defensive collective of democracies, just as the European Union had buried many of the nationalistic urges that had caused so much conflict in previous centuries. Putin had grudgingly accepted NATO's plans to expand, but now NATO seemed to loom over Ukraine. Like many in Russia's security establishment, he had been trained to subvert and, if necessary, fight NATO, and a sense of enmity lingered. Officials often cited reassurances that Mikhail Gorbachev believed he had been given during the reunification of Germany after 1989 that NATO would not expand to the east, though leaders of the United States and Europe insisted that no such reassurance had ever been made. It was humiliating enough that the Baltic nations had joined NATO, but influential American and European officials were now openly advocating the inclusion of still more former Soviet republics, including Georgia and Ukraine. The presence of American soldiers on our border has created a kind of paranoia in Russia, Putin's new foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, acknowledged in April 2004, when the ceremonial raising of the flags of the new member states took place outside the alliance's headquarters in Brussels. There were in fact no Americans deployed to the Baltic states, merely a rotating squadron of European fighter jets to patrol the skies over the new territories. But it seemed to Putin as if the enemy had reached the gates. They had to be stopped, and Putin drew the line at Ukraine. In Yalta, he and Kuchma discuss the integration of a proposed common economic space, a loose economic alliance between Russia and Ukraine, along with Belarus and Kazakhstan, that over the years would take shape as a more formal customs union, and finally, an economic and political bloc intended to rival the European Union. Putin had floated the idea the year before, but now he wanted Kuchma's explicit public support for it. This meant reversing a formal strategy that Kuchma's government had published a month before, calling for Ukraine to pursue membership in the European Union and NATO. Needing Russia's support in what was shaping up as a close election for his successors, one that could provide a tainted president with security after he left office, Kuchma succumbed to Putin's pressure. After their meeting, he announced that he had abandoned the strategy he had just announced and would only seek cordial relations with the alliances that dominated Europe, an abrupt reversal that stunned Ukraine's opposition. Behind closed doors, Putin and Kuchma also struck a side deal. They created a new energy trading company. It went by the unwieldy acronym Rosukrenergo, and its ownership remained deliberately vague. Half was owned by a branch of Gazprom, the gas monopoly in Russia that had increasingly become part of Putin's vision of a greater Russia, controlled by the Kremlin and led by his closest allies from Petersburg. The other half was owned by a shadowy company whose partners remained secret, their share managed by an Austrian bank, Raiffeisen International. The new company was registered neither in Russia nor in Ukraine, but rather in Switzerland. This murky deal underscored how Putin's concern about Ukraine's looming election extended far beyond politics alone, and how much financial concerns figured in most of his calculations. Natural gas, even more than oil, had become Russia's most powerful tool in foreign policy. Oil trades freely, sloshing through the world's economy. Gas requires fixed pipelines, linking the nations of Europe to Russia. The network of pipelines, dating to the Soviet era, gave Russia clout and, with rising energy prices, the prospect of the wealth that Putin, nearly a decade before, had argued in his dissertation was the core of the state's power. Ukraine, through which most of Russia's gas passed, represented a potential chokehold on Putin's ambitions. Putin was certain that he now faced a concerted effort to thwart his plans. When he appeared at Livadia Palace following his private talks with Kuchma and Yanukovych, Putin even used a KGB term for networks of agents and informants betraying the state on behalf of the countries trying to destroy it, Agentura. The Agentura, both inside our countries and outside, are trying everything possible to compromise the integration between Russia and Ukraine, he said. Look at my face, Viktor Yushchenko declared when he returned to Kiev on September 21st from treatment in the Austrian hospital. The source of his poisoning, even the fact of it, was not yet clear, but he went directly to the Ukrainian parliament, the Supreme Rada, to accuse unnamed enemies of trying to stop his candidacy. His appearance was sensational. Yushchenko, a central banker who helped create the country's new currency, the hryvnia, had served as Kuchma's prime minister for 2 years before he was ousted by those opposed to his westernizing vision for Ukraine's future. He strongly supported the European Union and NATO. The fact that his wife was a Ukrainian-American from the diaspora in Chicago only confirmed the worst to his critics, including Kuchma, who was heard in the secret recordings coarsely ranting that she was an operative of the CIA. He also had them both followed. Now, Yushchenko stood at the Rada's dais and accused Kuchma's allies of conspiring to murder him. What happened to me was not caused by food or my diet, but by the political regime in this country. Friends, we are not talking today about food, literally. We are talking about the Ukrainian political kitchen where murders are on the menu. Hidden under his suit, he had a catheter in his spine, pulsing sedatives to ease the pain he was experiencing. 4 days later, he flew back to Vienna for further treatment. Yushchenko was not a charismatic politician, but his campaign was well-funded and astute. It had chosen a simple message, Tak, or yes, and adopted the color orange, plastering the city with flags, banners, and ads. He also forged an alliance with Yulia Tymoshenko, a formidable nationalist and energy tycoon who had manipulated the collapsing Soviet system to enrich herself, as Mikhail Khodorkovsky had in Russia. Her ambition was astounding, and, as a woman in a political milieu dominated by men, she unabashedly used her attractiveness as a political prop, braiding her hair in a trademark peasant's rope. With Yushchenko sidelined for treatment, she carried the campaign for him, delivering blistering denunciations of Kuchma's rule and the prospect that Yanukovych would simply steer the country ever closer to Russia. As the election neared, Yushchenko's campaign gained momentum. The intelligence reports that reached Putin each morning must have confirmed his worst fears of Western nefariousness, detailing an elaborate plan to encircle Russia. What was happening in Ukraine must be a prelude to a final push into Russia itself. This plot owed much to the febrile imagination of Russia's intelligence services, but the United States, Germany, and other European nations fed the fever by supplying money to organizations in Ukraine that promoted democracy, civil society, legal reform, and environmentalism. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, these non-governmental organizations, NGOs, had operated throughout Eastern Europe, even in Russia, with the aim of assisting newly independent nations to make the transition from one-party systems to open, multi-party democracies. In Serbia in 2000, then in Georgia in 2003, they had provided support to peaceful political protests that ultimately overthrew sclerotic governments. Though their funding was modest, rarely more than a few million dollars or euros each, they represented the agentura that Putin feared. Russian businesses, under pressure from the Kremlin, countered with pledges of cash for Yanukovych at the same meeting in Yalta. Roughly half of the $600 million that Yanukovych's team was believed to have spent, the equivalent of 1% of the country's GDP, came from Russia. Signaling the depth of his personal involvement, Putin put his own chief of staff, Dmitry Medvedev, in charge of the Kremlin's political operation in Ukraine. Medvedev, who had run Sobchak's and Putin's campaigns in the past, dispatched trusted advisors, including Gleb Pavlovsky and Sergei Markov, to Ukraine. In August, the Kremlin's political operatives opened a space called Russia House in a central hotel in Kyiv, ostensibly to promote goodwill between Russia and Ukraine, but in reality, to run the Kremlin's campaign on Yanukovych's behalf. They orchestrated the same sort of operation that characterized Russia's elections, uncritical coverage on state television of set-piece rallies for Yanukovych, and vicious attacks on Yushchenko as an agent of the West. A cache of posters produced by Yanukovych's advisors showed Yushchenko's orange slogan under a picture of President Bush riding Ukraine like a cowboy. Yanukovych's wife, Lyudmila, ranted at a rally in Donetsk that the Americans provided Yushchenko's supporters with felt boots and oranges laced with narcotics, remarks that were promptly remixed into a pop song that provided a soundtrack for the upheaval to come. Putin, for his part, injected himself directly into the campaign, meeting with Kuchma and Yanukovych repeatedly. On the eve of the first round of voting, on October 31st, he traveled to Kyiv for a state visit that ostensibly celebrated the 60th anniversary of the Soviet Union's liberation of Ukraine from the Nazis in 1944. The night before the parade, he even appeared during prime time on three state television channels for a call-in interview, in which he affected magnanimity and concern for the issues facing Ukrainians. He nodded to Ukraine's independence and sovereignty, but also made it clear that a historical mistake had separated the two brotherly nations from their natural alliance. Several of the questions, which were sent in by email or fax or called in live, lamented the demise of the Soviet Union. One questioner asked Putin to run for president of Ukraine. Putin demurred. It was impossible to rebuild the Soviet Union, he said. But Ukraine's future lay in tightening its economic ties to Russia. He never mentioned Yushchenko, but five times he praised Yanukovych's stewardship as prime minister. Putin, by now used to these formats at home, exuded charm and humility. The announcer exclaimed that there were 600 calls a minute coming in on the phone lines. Putin recited, in Ukrainian, a fragment of a poem by Taras Shevchenko, Ukraine's national poet, although he had to admit that while he understood some Ukrainian, he did not speak it. A schoolboy named Andrei wanted to know if he could be photographed with him. "Vladimir Vladimirovich, do you believe in dreams?" he began. And the next day, Putin obliged, appearing with little Andrei in Kuchma's office and presenting him a laptop as a gift. During the military parade, Putin stood beside Kuchma and Yanukovych on the viewing stand as thousands of soldiers goose-stepped past wearing vintage uniforms and standards of the Red Army. At one point, Yanukovych tried to hand Putin a stick of chewing gum, prompting a look of astonished disgust at his coarse manners. However transparently staged, Putin's appearances resonated with some Ukrainians, those who envied Russia's rising standard of living or harbored the same nostalgia that many Russians did for the Soviet era. Ukraine, however, was more pluralistic than Russia, and its democracy less managed. State television served the power and assailed Yushchenko on a daily basis, insinuating that his illness was caused by sushi or syphilis. But Kuchma's control of the media was not absolute. Channel 5, owned by a chocolate tycoon, Petro Poroshenko, threw itself unabashedly behind Yushchenko. It became the voice of the opposition's campaign, prompting the government to try unsuccessfully to suspend its broadcasting license. Putin's unprecedented intervention in another country's election also played into the opposition's main argument, that a vote for Yanukovych would simply return the country to the empire from which it had gained independence. That anyone would ask Putin in earnest to become the leader of Ukraine was too much. The Kremlin's political apparatchiks never appreciated that, because Putin did not. Putin's strategists also miscalculated the degree to which the crude anti-Americanism that worked in Russia's politics would resonate in Ukraine. When the first round of the election was held on October 31st, Yushchenko collected 39.87% of the votes, edging out Yanukovych's 39.32%, with 20 minor candidates dividing the rest. Exit polls paid for by the Western Agentura had Yushchenko ahead by an even larger margin, and with widespread reports of ballot stuffing and other irregularities, some in the opposition, including Yulia Tymoshenko, wanted to protest in the streets, as they had been preparing to do all summer. Yushchenko, though, was content to celebrate his unexpectedly strong showing and vowed that he would prevail in the runoff scheduled for 3 weeks later on November 21st. After Yanukovych's lackluster showing, Putin redoubled his efforts. With both candidates courting the also-rans from the first round, Putin pressed Russia's communist leader Gennady Zyuganov to use his influence with Petro Simonenko, the Ukrainian communist candidate who had received 5% of the vote. Zyuganov agreed, but he had a price. The Kremlin had to provide financing to the Communist Party of Russia and end the relentlessly negative coverage of it on state television. The Kremlin did, for a while, but the tactic failed once Simonenko, too, was furious over the voting, believing that more than 50,000 communist votes had been stripped from him in the first round. Instead, he called on his party members to vote against both candidates in the runoff. Putin then traveled to Ukraine for yet another working visit, meeting Kuchma and Yanukovych in Crimea once again to inaugurate regular ferry service between the peninsula and the Russian mainland. And together, they traveled down the Crimean coast to the Artek International Children's Center, a famous Soviet-era resort that was then hosting hundreds of schoolchildren who had survived the terror attack in Beslan. The Kremlin's political operatives, including Medvedev, remained confident of Yanukovych's victory, in part because Kuchma and Yanukovych were. Still, Putin pressed Yanukovych to do more with the government resources at hand to boost turnout, a practice that had worked well in Russia. To prepare for the runoff, election officials padded voter lists with dead souls, suspiciously inflating the turnout in the eastern areas that supported Yanukovych. In Donetsk, the turnout for the second round jumped nearly 20% to an incredible 96.7%. On the day of the runoff, voters were bused to Kiev to vote after voting in their home districts. Hundreds of them were caught in the act. Yushchenko's campaign had anticipated fraud, but the flagrancy of it provoked outrage. By the time polls closed that night, his supporters, wearing orange and waving orange flags, poured into the streets around Kiev's central public space, Maidan Nezalezhnosti, or Independence Square. The crowds had grown to tens of thousands by the next morning when the Election Commission announced preliminary results that showed Yanukovych winning with 49% to Yushchenko's 46%, even though the exit polls paid for by NGOs from the United States and Europe showed the latter winning by 11 points. International election observers immediately raised questions about the conduct of the vote and the tally. But Putin, who had spent the previous 3 days in Latin America for a summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Nations, promptly telephoned from Brazil to congratulate Yanukovych. Yushchenko's supporters erected a tent city in the Maidan, vowing to remain until the election result was overturned. For all the outrage over the fraud, the mood of the crowd was festive. Pop musicians performed between the speeches of Yushchenko and his supporters. Kuchma's advisors were in disarray, divided over what to do. Journalists began revolting at the state television networks, including an interpreter for the deaf, who disregarded the official script of the anchor on the main state channel and began signing the truth. "The results announced by the Central Electoral Commission are rigged," she signed. "Do not believe them." When Kuchma's government made no immediate move to remove the protesters, more people poured into the square. Not just political activists, but ordinary people, even parents who took their children to witness what they felt was a historic moment in Ukraine's young history. It was suddenly more than an outpouring of support for Yushchenko. For all the country's problems, its crippling Soviet legacies, Ukrainians, unlike Russians, were willing to take to the streets to demand fairness and accountability from their leaders. On November 23rd, Yushchenko took a symbolic oath of office, proclaiming himself the winner in a quorumless session of parliament, only to have the Election Commission declare Yanukovych the official winner after the final tally the next day. Putin extended congratulations again, this time in a letter to Yanukovych, saying the Ukrainians had made a choice for stability. But the crowds grew even larger, laying siege to the parliament and presidential building in a sea of orange. It was Putin's worst nightmare. Putin flew from South America to Brussels for a meeting with the leaders of the European Union, most of whom had refused to recognize the election results in Ukraine and instead called for an investigation into the fraud. The chummy partnership that Putin hoped to develop with the Europeans, promising to expand cooperation on energy, security, trade, and travel, had grown increasingly strained, and Ukraine all but broke it. "I am convinced that we have no more right to incite mass disturbances in a major European state," Putin said after a tense private meeting with the leaders. He was accusing them of encouraging the people massed in the streets of Kiev. "We must not make it an international practice to resolve disputes of this kind through street riots." Putin's insistence that the outcome was absolutely clear left Russia with no alternative strategy, and the Kremlin struggled to keep up with the pace of events. Ukraine's parliament, sensing the political tide turning toward Yushchenko, voted to declare the election results invalid. Members of Ukraine's security forces, including the secretive successor to the KGB, began to break ranks and side with the protesters. Ihor Shmishko, the general who had attended the late-night dinner before Yushchenko's disfiguring illness 2 months before, now also swung against the Yanukovych camp, warning that the country's interior troops would resist any order to crack down. Putin had pressed Kuchma to resist the momentum toward a compromise, hinting strongly that he should deal firmly with the mass protest. "Putin is a hard man," Kuchma said later. It wasn't like he was saying directly, "Put tanks on the streets." He was tactful in his comments, but there were some hints made. Yanukovych retreated to Donetsk, his hometown, to attend a congress of political leaders from the eastern regions that remained deeply loyal to him and to Russia. Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv. Meeting in a skating rink in Severodonetsk, the Congress voted unanimously to declare their regions autonomous if the chaos in Kiev persisted. The regional assembly then moved up a vote on autonomy to the following week. Yuri Lushkov, the mayor of Moscow, attended and seemed to lend the Kremlin's endorsement to the calls for separatism. He denounced the opposition leaders as a Sabbath of witches, pretending to represent the whole of the nation. The Donbas, as Ukraine's industrial heartland was known, would split before agreeing to any compromise that would install Yushchenko. On the night of December 2nd, Putin summoned Kuchma to Moscow. They met in the VIP lounge of Vnukovo Airport as Putin prepared to depart on a state visit to India. In Ukraine, the parliament continued to debate the mechanics of holding new elections, while the country's highest court heard Yushchenko's arguments for nullifying the results of the last one. Putin now embraced Kuchma's call for an entirely new vote as the best chance to head off Yushchenko's victory. "A rerun of the second round may also produce nothing," Putin declared. "What happens then? Will there have to be a third, a fourth, a 25th round until one of the sides obtains the necessary result?" The next day, after a week of hearings that were broadcast around the country, Ukraine's highest court intervened to order a new runoff, saying the second round had been so marred by systematic and massive violations that it was impossible to determine who had genuinely won. It was an unmitigated victory for Yushchenko, and the center of Kiev erupted in celebration. For Putin, it was an unmitigated defeat. 3 weeks later, a repeat of the runoff election was held. Between the court's ruling and the voting, Yushchenko's doctors in Austria had finally determined that he had been poisoned by dioxin. The accusations that Yushchenko's illness had been a stunt, exploiting some other illness to win voters' sympathy, now seemed a cynical cover-up of some dark conspiracy by a deeply corrupt system willing to stoop to poisoning to derail a candidate. When the second runoff was held, under even greater international scrutiny, Yushchenko won with almost 52% of the vote. Yanukovych trailed with 44%. Despite an investigation, the question of who poisoned him was never answered. Yushchenko himself showed an odd lack of zeal for the investigation despite the horrible disfigurement it caused. He would later say that he suspected his host, Volodymyr Satsuk. Once Yushchenko was in office, Satsuk was questioned by investigators and his dacha tested for traces of dioxin, but he was never declared a suspect. In June 2005, Satsuk left Ukraine for Russia, where he received citizenship. Yushchenko came to believe that Putin was harboring his would-be killer. The Orange Revolution, as it became known, was treated in Russia as a humiliating defeat, and in the Kremlin as an ominous warning. Putin, the tactician, had been outmaneuvered in a geopolitical struggle, and he nursed the experience like a grudge. The Kremlin responded by intensifying pressure on Russia's NGOs, by redoubling its hunt for foreign spies, and by creating its own youth movement to contain any manifestation of youthful dissent. It was called Nashi, and its ideology and practices bore more than a passing resemblance to those of the Soviet Union's Komsomol, or even, to critics, the Hitler Youth. Putin acted increasingly defensive and increasingly suspicious of international rebukes about Russia's record on basic democratic rights. He found them hypocritical, especially coming from the United States, which under President Bush was pursuing a hyper-aggressive foreign policy that had overthrown governments in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now, he believed, Ukraine. His initially warm relations with Bush had cooled and were about to get colder. Shortly after Bush's inauguration for a second term in January 2005, the two met in Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia. Bush had delivered a speech that morning in the city's Vjezdoslav Square, only hours before Putin flew into the city. He had made the advancement of democracy, the freedom agenda, he called it, a central theme of his second term, and now he cheered the popular uprisings in Georgia and Ukraine. The recent elections in Iraq, he said, were part of the inevitable march of democracy that had begun with the Velvet Revolution in the then-unified Czechoslovakia in 1989. He did not mention Russia, but he declared that, eventually, the call of liberty comes to every mind and every soul, and one day, freedom's promise will reach every people and every nation. In Slovakia, the two presidents were accompanied by their wives, who appeared with them for an official photograph in falling snow at the entrance to Bratislava Castle. After tea, Ludmila, whose public activities had perceptibly diminished after Putin's re-election the year before, joined Laura Bush on a tour of the tapestries at the Primašal Palace in the heart of the city's old center. Together, they listened to a boys' choir sing in Russian and English. When the two men met inside the castle, however, Putin dropped any pretense of good-natured friendship. When Bush raised his concerns about the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the strangulation of the media, the lack of progress on democracy, Putin counterattacked. He compared his decision to end the elections of regional governors, announced after Beslan, to the use of the Electoral College in American presidential elections. The prosecution of Khodorkovsky was no different than the prosecution of Enron, the Texas-based energy company that went bankrupt in 2001. It went on for nearly 2 hours. Putin's tone was mocking and sarcastic, irritating Bush to the point that he imagined reaching over to slap the hell out of the interpreter. "Don't lecture me about the free press," Putin sneered at Bush at one point. "Not after you fired that reporter." Bush was momentarily puzzled. Then he realized that Putin meant a scandal that had erupted over reporting by Dan Rather for CBS on Bush's service in the Air National Guard, which was based on documents that could not be authenticated. Rather had had to apologize and was forced to retire, and now Putin was citing it to accuse Bush of suppressing freedom of the press. "I strongly suggest you not say that in public," Bush told him. "The American people will think you don't understand our system." Later, their joint press conference revealed how their differences could no longer be papered over for the sake of diplomacy. Putin repeated his assertion that the Electoral College was a fundamentally undemocratic practice. A Russian journalist chosen by the Kremlin then raised the issue that Putin had just discussed with Bush privately, asking Putin why he had not raised publicly the violation of rights in the United States. "What a coincidence," Bush said he thought. The partnership Bush had imagined when he looked into Putin's eyes 4 years before never really recovered. "Perhaps we should have seen it coming," Condoleezza Rice, now Bush's Secretary of State, later wrote. But this Putin was different than the man who we had first met in Slovenia. Ukraine's election, coming in the wake of Beslan, proved to be a turning point for Putin and for Russia. His initial instinct to bring Russia into closer cooperation with the West, if not an actual alliance, had faded as steadily as his political and economic power had grown. When he delivered his annual address to the Duma and Federation Council in April, he appealed for a new national unity against those who would challenge the state, inside or outside Russia. He began with a preamble that the country needed to consider the deeper meaning of such values as freedom and democracy, justice and legality. and went on to utter a sentence that to many confirmed the worst about Putin's instincts, a lingering nostalgia for the glory of the Soviet Union. "First of all," he said, "it should be recognized that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. For the Russian people, it became a real drama. Tens of millions of our fellow citizens and compatriots found themselves outside Russian territory. The epidemic of disintegration also spread to Russia itself." Putin did not wish to restore the Soviet or communist system. Anyone who wants to, he had said, has no brain. But for the first time, he began casting his leadership in a broader historical context. He meant to restore something much older, much richer and deeper. The idea of the Russian nation, the imperium of the Third Rome, charting its own course, indifferent to the imposition of foreign values. It was an old Russian idea, and he found the model for it in the history books he was said to favor. Far less noted at the time than Putin's lament for the catastrophe of the Soviet collapse was his reference to Ivan Ilyin, a religious and political philosopher arrested repeatedly by the Bolsheviks and finally expelled in 1922. Ilyin's ideas provided an intellectual foundation for Putin's evolving understanding of Russia's revival, and would become more prominent in subsequent political debates. As a white Russian in exile, Ilyin embraced a vision of an Orthodox Russian identity that the secular communist system was bent on destroying. In his writings, Putin found much to sustain the state he wanted to create, even the notion of sovereign democracy. Putin was not lamenting the demise of the Soviet system, but the demise of the historical Russian idea. It was the first time Putin had quoted Ilyin, whose writings only began circulating openly in Russia after Perestroika. "Let us not forget this," Putin said. "Russia is a country that has chosen democracy through the will of its own people. It chose this road of its own accord, and it will decide itself how best to ensure that the principles of freedom and democracy are realized here, taking into account our historic, geopolitical, and other particularities, and respecting all fundamental democratic norms. As a sovereign nation, Russia can and will decide for itself the time frame and conditions for its progress along this road." Putin's reference to a philosopher little known outside or even inside Russia coincided with the repatriation of his remains, along with those of General Anton Denikin, a Tsarist commander on the losing side of the Civil War. Ilyin had been buried in Switzerland, Denikin in the United States, but Putin supported the campaign to reinter them in their homeland at the Donskoy Monastery in Moscow. He was said to have personally paid for Ilyin's new headstone. All this led to a revival of interest in the man's works. The Central Intelligence Agency scrambled to prepare an analysis examining their role in Putin's thinking and what it might portend for the future. Ilyin advanced orthodoxy, patriotism, the law, and private property as the foundations of a state. Writing from exile through Stalin's reign and the Great Patriotic War, he eulogized the heroes of the Civil War with a reverence and romanticism whose echoes reverberated in the new Russia. Putin could find much to like in Ilyin's words. "The hero takes up the burden of his nation, the burden of its misfortunes, of its struggle, of its quest, and having taken up that burden, he wins. Wins already by this alone, indicating to all the way to salvation. And his victory becomes a prototype and a beacon, an achievement and the call, the source of victory and the beginning of victory for everyone connected with him into one whole by patriotic love. That's why he remains for his people a living source of cheer and joy, and his very name sounds like victory." On May 9, 2005, the Kremlin celebrated the 60th anniversary of the victory in the Great Patriotic War with a ceremony more extravagant than ever. The grandiose plans included dozens of ceremonies and concerts and a military parade through Red Square, a tradition that Putin resumed after the years when Yeltsin played down Soviet holidays and traditions. The parade was attended by 57 dignitaries, including the leaders of victorious and vanquished nations of the war, from George Bush to Gerhard Schroeder, Silvio Berlusconi, and Junichiro Koizumi. For Putin, the war became the keynote of his new nationalism, one very much shaped by the memories he had of listening to his father's stories. The anniversary's approach had revived the debates over the Soviet subjugation of Eastern and Central Europe after the war, but Putin rebuffed calls for Russia to account for the darker aspects of the Soviet past, most notoriously the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact with Nazi Germany in 1939, which led to the Soviet occupation of part of Poland that year and the Baltic states a year later. The presidents of Lithuania and Estonia refused to attend as a result. The attendance of Latvia's president, Vaira Vika Freiberga, prompted raucous protests by Nazi activists outside the country's embassy in Moscow. For his role in brokering talks during the election in Ukraine, Aleksander Kwaśniewski of Poland was conspicuously snubbed, relegated to the back row of the viewing stand that discreetly covered Lenin's tomb. Putin would no more concede Stalin's failures during the war, including the pre-war complicity with Hitler, the useless slaughter of ordinary soldiers, the marauding countermarch to Berlin, than Soviet propagandists had. The war of Putin's new ideology was the war of his youth, honorable, righteous, unblemished, and unrepentant. The battles of Moscow and Stalingrad, the courage of besieged Leningrad, and the successes at Kursk and on the Dnieper decided the outcome of the Great Patriotic War, he said. Through the liberation of Europe and the battle for Berlin, the Red Army brought the war to its victorious conclusion. Dear friends, we never divided victory into ours and theirs. He noted that the common sacrifice united the 15 republics of the Soviet Union, now independent nations pursuing their own paths in the case of the Baltic countries, Georgia, and, much to Putin's frustration, Ukraine. The reconciliation of Germany and Russia, he said, should be a model of international relations for the 21st century. Not far from the Kremlin, though, the Pushkin Museum commemorated the 60th anniversary with a display of 552 ancient works of art, including Greek bronzes, Etruscan figures, and fragments of Roman wall paintings that the Soviet Union had seized from a bunker in Berlin, and that Russia still refused to return.